Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. Welcome to 2019, and we're back with part 2 of episode 51, where we're continuing to discuss The Tyranny of Light by Harriet Tsoukas. To get the text and for more information, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
What I'd like to do now is open up part 2 with a different look at the paradoxes, particularly the first one of more information, less understanding. What I'd like to do is to frame it a different way, which is not so paradoxical, but which I think more information may, you know, it would be a different relationship. More information, more exposed disunderstanding. My point on that is that I don't know necessarily that the creation of more information or the proliferation of more information necessarily creates more understanding so much that it exposes the misunderstandings that are already out there. And I use the prefix dis because I think at some point, in a lot of ways, the misunderstandings that pre-existed that are being exposed were already socially shaped or socially constructed as an interpretation or a reinterpretation of events. And so let me give a couple of examples of what I'm referring to. So you have the say-do gap, which is an internal inconsistent form of communication. You're saying one thing, doing another, or saying one thing to one and saying something else to another. It's rooted in a perception or a view of the world that you already had. The more transparent then, or the more available that information is and your ability to inject into it, you're now exposing your misunderstanding of the situation to a broader global audience. Say hear caps are kind of the same way. How we mishear or misunderstand privately is now becoming more exposed. And also, there was a kind of a third category, which is sort of like a very intentional disinformation, where you have your perspective in which you really want to shape, and you put it out. And now you have the means to put your views out there intentionally to either, I don't want to say attack, but to basically put your view out there for the purposes of stifling or constraining or misshaping the information that is already out there to pursue some particular interest. In a lot of ways, I mean, I see that, you know, less understanding is one way of characterizing it. What I'm kind of getting at is that the more information or the more transparency means there's a lot that's privately held that is now available. And so now it's a question of sifting what is useful versus what is not useful.
Interesting. So it's sort of like a way of collective verification, almost, that it's more information becomes a way to double check whether what you said, for example, landed the way you intended to, right?
That's part of it. Part of it is also that, by your ability to, you know, not just landed, but also are you silencing or trying to have your information, your perspective dominate other views? And sort of comes the internet shouting match, if you will, or I should say social media shouting match.
Indeed. So what is the value of understanding in this situation? What do we understand by understanding?
I think a start point to answering that is if the idea is that there is some sort of a truth out there, like if we are going to be talking about objectifying, a goal would be to expose more misunderstanding for the purposes of correcting. I'm a little uncomfortable using that term, but correcting that misunderstanding such that the real, no kidding, objective truth emerges. Now, of course, that may be what each individual in this information society may want, but because you have so many strongly held different points of view, then this attempt to correct others' misunderstanding could potentially, you know, it's basically it elevates to more of a debate or devolves into a shouting match.
Right, and it's contested, obviously. It's a contested environment where the different sort of corrective agendas correct one another still. So it highlights, I think, and Tsoukas goes at that too, the very different way of thinking about what is information and knowledge. So whether we're talking about objectification that different parties engage in, or we're talking about reification, the subtle difference being objectification referring to a more kind of Aristotelian version of knowledge, that it's a true, verifiable belief that we kind of hone in on, and more information on the one hand, what you said, Tom, it allows us to hone in more accurately. We have a better beeping signal, if you will. And on the other hand, it allows to either obscure or further highlight what is a belief that may be verifiable and ultimately potentially true. On the other hand, we have the reification, which is a construction of truth, not in a social constructivist sense that kind of what we agree on, butchering this obviously, but what we agree on is kind of what it becomes, but more about building the truth out of the building blocks of the environment and of social agreements. And that is to do more with what are the consequences of action taken upon information and understanding. So essentially, does it work? Kind of think of a pragmatic way of viewing knowledge. We have this information. This is what we make sense of it. So let's put it into practice. And does it work? Does it work for us? Does it work for some segment of our peers? If yes, or more or less, I suppose, then that now becomes a reified understanding, reified knowledge. And he seems to advocate in this paper, and in a lot of his subsequent work, that is the essence of kind of knowledge in this in the world where we are now, that it is a an ability to reify information into practice. And the degree to which it is considered to be a success at the local, factional, special interest level, whatever you name it, basically where it matters. Are you able to materialize information where it matters well enough for it to be considered true? And if you can, there and then it will be true. And that is what we can understand.
It would also seem to be the way that misinformation can become widely spread and entrenched. If you have if you're reifying information and you're sharing it with those who, like, for example, you know, agree with you on that because they share your perspective, whether it's just, you know, your close friends who live relatively together, you're like-minded in many ways, then you sort of reinforce this information among yourselves, and then it grows and grows such that even though those of us with a different perspective might be able to point out that belief, that reified belief, is not objectively true, it's demonstrably false, it still persists. It becomes a very entrenched shared understanding that becomes very difficult to break.
Yeah, absolutely. If you and your echo chamber can successfully function based on the information that you perpetuate, then that is considered true, you know, at least for that part. It is when these reifications collide, especially within the broader political economy of knowledge, that is where you kind of end up with having debates and the shouting matches and more serious contestations of what knowledge is, what understandings are. So as you enter arenas where the reification has higher stakes to it, when you know, it's people's lives are at stake or large sums of resources and so on and so forth, that is where this becomes more consequential than if it's just a YouTube commentary feed or you know, like a Twitter rant. And the disconcerting part of it is kind of what Tsukas highlights here is what would be the value that we place on the interpretive lenses, whether this is technology and whether it's patterns and AI of some sort, or whether it's individuals who are experts and are sensitive to particular contexts that are relevant to whatever is being discussed.
There's also this critique of the process of knowing, which we could call epistemology, which is not so much which of these realities that you're describing or perspectives that you're describing, Dimitris, are preferable. Rather, we should be aware and reflexive about what happens when we seek to understand something. And because it's complex and we want to control it or understand it at a distance, we set up a particular way of investigating it, of inspecting it. And this goes back to philosophy of science kind of more broadly, and history of science and technology as well, where we have certain methods for grasping at the world. And this paper is part of a broader kind of shaking up of the Enlightenment ideal that just by shedding more light and by getting better observatory tools, we will see more clearly and we will get at that objective truth unproblematically. Whereas what something like creating a league table does is transform the phenomenon that you're trying to capture. For example, schools, which are judged on standardized testing outcomes, it's well known that they tend to start teaching to the test. And so it changes teaching practice, changes the way that schools are resourced. And when I was a high school teacher in a school where standardized testing was the way in which you were judged and funded, I've seen what this can do in the classroom before and after. You know, suddenly we're spending money on dictionaries instead of novels because they're tested on knowledge of vocabulary. So it's that in trying to capture reality, you change reality. It's worth highlighting that so that we don't do it unknowingly, I guess, because I'm not sure that there's much of an alternative. We're going to need to reduce reality to some sort of set of indicators to be able to act as managers and as politicians and so forth. But we should be aware of what that does.
Well, the downside of this is relativism, right? If you... Yes. Unless you reduce reality to, or you know, the understanding, so kind of to get less ontological here, if you reduce understanding to a narrow set of options, you get totalitarian and, you know, you become a mm-hmm. demagogue in a sense. But there is less uncertainty. So think of kind of the founder figure in an organization or this my way or the highway, or you know, even the up or out philosophies that many organizations have. That think that those are good examples of narrowing down set of available different contexts for evaluation, for information gathering, for decision making, you name it. On the other hand, what you risk is near total relativism, accepting that every context is valid and trying mm-hmm. to shape decision-making according to it. I'm not even sure if organizations can function that way. How would you allocate any resources, right?
Yeah, all perspectives are valid. Well, who gets the money?
I think something that can help is to cheat a little bit and to go forward to 2010, where Tsukas was essentially gave what he at that time thought was... a definition of knowledge in this sense, and this paper has certainly been the beginning of it. And for him, essentially, it was ability to differentiate between contexts. And here we can see the introduction of the different contexts. So knowledge and understanding is then dependent upon the ability to see and distinguish between these different, as you earlier referred to, realities that people build between these different reifications of information.
Is there any way in which that form of seeing and knowing could be reduced to a dashboard, the sorts of things that are very popular in management practice for very good practical reasons? Is it possible to access that kind of knowing through the kinds of representations that are widely used and available in organizations today, do you think?
It's possible to reduce it a way of knowing, because as Tom pointed out in part one, aptly, that stuff is still designed by someone. We didn't synthesize it out of our minds, you know. We don't have an individual dashboard in our contact lens yet that we could filter through, like, you know, the in the Predator movies where he just filters through different ways of seeing the world. You know, we can't
coming soon.
Yeah, we can't do that. But essentially, being knowledgeable is having the ability to do that on some sort of a social level, to be able to overlay different filters of assumptions and consequences and investments upon situations and figuring out what is where and how you fit in and what you can or cannot do then in them. Jamming it into a dashboard on an ICT system kind of restricts you to only one lens.
What I was going to say is that the example that I gave about database engineering is only half the story. You know, yes, it is the database engineer can only design the database according to what the organization needs. But when we're talking about, like, Ellie, your example with high schools is perfect for this, is that no organizational dashboard is going to capture the totality of the societal environment that affects the ability of the students to learn, which in turn means that no matter what, I mean, basically what we're reducing things within an organization boundary. We're creating a boundary around the organizational environment, trying to manage the information that does not, or we will not allow it to permeate the boundary outside of the organization. And so the discussions about, or a lot of the criticisms when we went to the same sort of standardized testing models within the United States, it was all about, well, all of the things that are really important for trying to solve the problems of education involve things that don't happen inside the school walls. So what problem are we trying to solve? But I kind of infer it from his discussion about hyper-democracy, where the special interests are not just trying to, you know, pursue their interest. They're also interested in shaping or constraining the boundaries of the problem space in which they're discussing information and knowledge. Yeah, and that's kind of a different nuance, I think.
Well, one of the interesting kind of counterpoints as well is how these things, which sound kind of negative, like people starting to manage league tables and people are reducing their practice to suit whatever higher ups are projecting on them as valuable criteria. But I've also experienced working for a not-for-profit that was concerned with inequality in the schooling system, that it was important for the not-for-profit to be able to draw on that data to show that there was inequality in the first place, because that was a contested truth within the conversation that was happening at the time. And so that really threw me, because I was critical of the way in which this testing was changing teaching practice, but then it was also being kind of co-opted back to be used as a kind of persuasive force within the same system. So I get that these things are kind of not one way. It's not straightforward. Those complexities are something that I think are worth grappling with.
There's a whole range of other topics. I mean, it's not just education. It's just about anything, I suppose, that we're discussing in which the society intrudes upon an organization, in an organization's boundary, where this sort of challenge occurs. Another example that comes to mind is diversity. And the import, there's no question that diversity is considered to be important, but efforts to try to determine what diverse, well, even the definition of diversity, you know, how's as far as diverse in what ways, what differences are important that an organization needs to enhance in order to perform better in some way. That's another example of an area in which we do quite a lot of objectifying. I mean, in terms of quantification, it's not just quantification in terms of statistics, but it's also guided by impressions and perceptions as far as what is considered to be sufficiently diverse versus not sufficiently diverse. That's a challenging one, because, like, for example, in an organization which you have up or out, if you want to shape a diverse workforce, you've got to be, you know, planting the seeds now in order to realize the results of it, say, 15, 20 years from now.
And that's all for part 2 of episode 51. If you're enjoying the discussion, please let us know via our Twitter account, Facebook, or by going to our website and leaving some feedback. Please tell your friends, colleagues, and students about the podcast. There's lots of exciting stuff happening in 2019 for the Talking About Organizations, and we're very excited to share and announce as much of that to you as possible in the near future. Meanwhile, please join us next week as we conclude The Tyranny of Light by Harry Tsukas, here on Talking About Organizations.